Well, our whole topic here is on parenting. And I want to start off by reading from a quote actually taken out of a book that was written at the end of the 1800s by J.C. Ryle called The Duties of Parents. And what he said back then is still incredibly relevant to us today. He said, and let me quote, "Home is a place where habits are formed. Home is a place where the foundations of character are laid. Home gives the bias to our tastes, likes, and opinions. See then, I pray you, that there be careful training at home." End of quote. And I love that quote. Because in all the work and all the counseling I've done over the last 35, 40 years in ministry, I realize how profound that is. The quality of what happens in the home directly affects that particular child, that individual, as they grow up, the rest of their life. And you make impressions upon children. And we're going to find out a little bit later on, we cannot guarantee how our kids are going to turn out. Nothing in the Bible ever guarantees that. All right? But we still have a stewardship responsibility before God to do the right thing and then let God work in our child's life. But there's no magical spiritual buttons that you can push, button A, B, C, that'll cause my child to turn out a certain way. You can't do that. Each child is individual. They have their own tastes, their likes, their dislikes. And so as a Christian parent, of course, you're concerned about ultimate outcomes. But there is an element at which you have to trust God and what God is doing supernaturally in that child's life. One of our own children, when they became a teenager, unlike our other kids, who they had their own individual problems, but this particular child was really weighing whether or not to walk away from the faith, to walk away from Christ. And that was a difficult time for us as parents. Praying for them, helping them, encouraging them. And we had many, many discussions between us during that particular time. And I said, believe it or not, I view this time in that particular child's life as being a very good time, because they are weighing whether or not Christ is going to be their Lord, not just their parents' Lord. They are weighing whether or not they're going to own their own Christianity. And the fact that they go through that time of questioning in and of itself is not bad, because that's when they're going weighing. Of course, how they ultimately come out the other end, you're very concerned about. But sometimes, as parents, you don't know in the midst of it how they're going to come out. You can see the wonder in their mind, the questioning that goes on. You can see that. And besides that, we live in a unique world today. Things are changing rapidly. And things are going to happen with your children, if you have younger children right now, that are radically different than what happened with me and my wife and our children as we raised them, because of the rapid nature in which the world is changing. I just got a phone call just 3 weeks ago from a pastor in the Midwest. In fact, I think back several years ago, both Jason and Veronica remember this guy, because they went to school with this particular guy. He's a pastor of a sizable church in the Midwest, and he called me up almost in panic, got me out of bed. He forgot what California time was. And he said, "Dr. Street, I got to tell you, I got to share with you a scenario." And let me share with you just a little bit of what he shared. He says, "Today, the local school system called one of our parents in the church and asked the mother and father to come and meet there at the school," which was a public high school. And the father went and picked up the mother, and they met, and they had no idea. They weren't told ahead of time what this meeting was all about. And they walked into this room, and there were four or five board administrators from the school that were sitting there, along with the school counselor and one of the teachers, and there was their 15-year-old son. And they had a, they sat down, and the school said, well, we're very happy that you're here. We want to let you know today that your son has announced to us that he no longer wants to be a boy. He wants to be a girl. And from this particular time forward, he no longer wants to be called by his male name. He wants to be called by his new female name. And that we as a school are totally supportive of your son. And we're here to make sure that you as parents are going to be supportive of that as well. How about that? This is when the school system becomes the bully. All right? And, of course, this is the first time they had no idea that their son was thinking in these terms. This was just news that was just all of a sudden dropped on them out of nowhere. And the father had presence of mind to say, well, thank you for informing us of this. We'll go home and we'll talk together about it as a family, and we'll let you know what we plan to do. And so they took their son and went home, and of course they went right to their pastor and told their pastor what had just happened, and the pastor called me and said, what do I do? And I said, number one, you need to get that kid out of that school system as quick as possible. Just get him out of there. I don't care what you do, just get him out of that system. Whether you homeschool him or whether you send him to the local Christian school, whatever the case may be, you've got to get him out of there. That's the first thing. Because we live in a culture that is determined by a theory out there. It's called the social construction of reality theory. And that social construction of reality theory dominates everything. It basically says that anybody can define themselves any way they want, and everybody's got to be supportive of that. So if you want to define yourself as a guy or a girl or an animal, it doesn't matter. You can define yourself that way. And nobody has a right to tell you anything different. So it all has to do with self-definition. And then I told the pastor, I said, I gave him the name of a couple of legal societies, Christian legal societies, that love to take up these kind of cases. And I said, you need to prepare yourself legally. And you need to help those parents prepare themselves legally. And then you need to start counseling the parents, and you need to start counseling their son. I just got an email from him just 2 hours ago from that particular pastor. So I want you to know that this is the type of society in which your kids are growing up in. And it's everywhere. Even though you may homeschool your child or you may send your child to a Christian school, that they're not immune from this because it's everywhere. It's everywhere. So let's take a look at some of this, especially in dealing with child rearing. What does the Bible say about it? What does the Bible say that are the foundational concepts of child rearing that we need to pay attention to? So let's begin by talking about that. And this evening, we're really, the first session that we're going to do this evening is going to be divided into two parts because it's an extra long session, all right? So we're not going to actually do two full sessions tonight. We're going to do one session, two parts, okay? But we want to talk a little bit about this parenting and use the book of Proverbs as a good paradigm for us as Christians to think this through, especially in our contemporary culture today. So let's take a look at this if we can. Your children are going to face experiences at a much younger age and make decisions about those experiences that you did not have to face until you were much older. That is just a reality. And it's becoming more true with information technology advancing and how quickly they have access to information. You've seen that little thing that floats around on Facebook, talks about don't look down on your parents because they made it through high school without Google. Well, they did. They made it through high school. That search machines were called card catalogs. All right, that's with search machines back in old times in the library. Those card catalogs where you searched out topics. Now, a kid has at their access information from all over the world right there in their little cell phone. Most Christian young people today experience so much so young. And the habits of decision-making that they're forming in reaction to those particular experiences stay with them the rest of their lives. We genuinely function in a hyper-postmodern world. And one of the most critical roles is to help our children, that we have as parents, I should say, is to help our children develop the intellectual capacity and especially the spiritual capacity to make informed, godly decisions that honor the Lord with their lives. Sometimes we can give them a direction, we can point them in the right way, but then they're going to have to make the decision on whether or not they're going to follow that. So Christian parenting in the 21st century presents a whole new set of challenges. Even though you and I have been 7 years old, we've been 11 years old, we've been 13 years old, we've been 17 years old, we were never the age that our kids are. Because you and I have never faced the choices that they've had to face so young. How do you handle parenting an MTV, Xbox, iPod, cell phone, instant messaging generation in the midst of rapidly changing societal sexual customs, homosexuality, lesbianism, self-definition of sexuality, transgenderism? Not only are those things accepted in society, they're even praised in society. You have new designer drugs, specialty alcoholic drinks, ever-changing cultural morality. All of this is really key. And there is a sense in which, and we're going to talk about this tomorrow, especially since Pastor Jason brought up the issue of remembering that message that I preached about in terms of self-love and self-esteem. We're going to talk about some of that really in relationship to what Scripture says in terms of child-rearing. 2 Timothy 3, 1 through 4 gives us a list of what the last days are going to be like. And at the very top of that list, it says men will be self-lovers. They will be self-lovers. They will be drunk on self. Now, I was taught when I went through college and university getting my bachelor's degree, I was taught that that was a virtue. The Apostle Paul says it's a vice to love self. It's not a virtue at all. It's a vice. And there's a sense in which the challenges have changed, but the children have not. So as Christians, it's imperative that we view the Scriptures not as one of the answers out there, but as the answer to rearing children in the 21st century. We have to do that. Which really brings us to a really critical verse. And that is a verse, probably it is the most misunderstood verse in all the Bible when it comes to child rearing. It is the most misused verse in all the Bible when it comes to child rearing. And it is the verse that, if you don't understand it right, really sets you up for horrible disappointment as a parent. And that is the verse of Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 6. If you want to take your Bible, let's go over there. Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 6. Here it says, train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. Now, that's probably one of the most quoted verses in the Bible when it comes to parenting. And the way that you understand that verse and think about that verse has an enormous effect on how you conceive of your role as a parent. So the critical question is, what does this verse mean? Does it guarantee that if I bring up my child in the right way when he or she is old or older, they will not depart from it? I want you to think about that for a moment. Because I want to suggest to you that a lot of Christian parents view a verse like that as primarily a guarantee. This is a verse that's often understood to be a promise. I mean, God's given me a promise. If I bring up my child the right way, when that child is old, that child will not depart from the right way. So, as a result of that, there are some well-meaning Christian parents that think if they're able to shield their children from society and only provide them with the right type of Christian influences, then those children will grow up to be good Christians. When you think about it, the secular psychologist B.F. Skinner would be very proud of that kind of parenting. He would be proud of the fact that basically you're conditioning your kids to grow up as a Christian, and so once that conditioning is imprinted upon their psyche, then they're never going to leave that. That's the way they're always going to be. It's the environment that causes your child to go wrong, and so as a result of that, you put them in a good environment. Your child is sort of born neutral or like a blank slate. An environment marks that child for good or for bad. So you give the child the right environment, and he or she is going to grow up right. So there are really a lot of Christian parents in viewing Proverbs 22:6 are sort of Skinnerian in their parenting. If I provide all the right kind of influences, then my child's going to grow up the right way. But we run into problems, and you and I know these problems. One of them is, you know of kids who grew up in wonderful Christian homes. I mean, mom and dad were not perfect, but they were wonderful Christian homes, and mom and dad really loved their kids, and they poured their heart into their kids. And those kids grew up and walked away from the faith. And you say, how is that possible? And then you know of other kids who grew up in horrible homes, terrible homes. Mom and dad were ungodly. And they did ungodly things. And sometimes they actually did ungodly things to their children. And those kids grew up and become committed Christians. How is that possible? If the environment determines the child, then how could anybody coming out of a bad home turn out so good? How could anybody coming out of a good home turn out so bad? How is that possible? And we all know examples of this. Well, a lot of this goes back to how carefully we've really paid attention to what Scripture says. That's so key. Now, certainly, when you read the English translation of this particular verse, you could hypothetically understand it as a promise and a guarantee. But I also want you to understand that this verse can be properly understood another way. And it seems like the phrase that seems to be important here is a little phrase, in the way he should go. See that little phrase in the verse? In the way that he should go. And it's very interesting because the Hebrew literally says there, literally it says, upon the mouth of his way. The first word of that verse in the Hebrew is the word hanach. It means dedicate. Dedicate a child upon the mouth of his way. Upon the mouth of his way. I know there are some Christian parents who take that to mean, and it's been horribly taught to mean, well, you know, if your child's given to music, then you need to bring them up with a music environment. If they're given to athletics, you need to bring them up in an athletic environment. If the child's given to mathematics, then you need to provide a lot of mathematics for that child and stuff like that. That's not at all what this verse is saying. I can just really rule that out right away. It doesn't even come anywhere close to what this verse is saying. What does it mean to dedicate, or here, in fact, when they use the word train, that's the only time in the entire English translation of the Bible that the word hanach is translated train. In every other case, it's translated dedicate. All right, it's the same word that's used where Solomon dedicates the temple. Hanach. All right, dedicating the temple. Dedicate a child upon the mouth of his way. What does that mean? So this is key. This is what we've got to take a look at. Now, this next slide, I was just going through my slides a little bit earlier this evening, and I realized that I have a new computer, and as soon as you put slides on a new computer, it changes all the Hebrew font. And so it turns out as gibberish here. Oh, no, it didn't. Well, no, yeah. Well, don't ask me. I got the first word right. Harnach. All right, but the rest of it is just gibberish. Dedicate a child or a boy on the mouth of his way. That's what literally you're reading it from right to left. Dedicate a child upon the mouth of his way. And it says, even when he is old. Now, why it translates, I mean, I actually have the word for dedicate and the word for old there, but the rest of it is just gibberish. But even when he is old, he will not turn aside from it. So the question is, what is this saying? Does it mean that it is a guarantee or it's a promise that if you provide all the right significant elements in that child's environment, then that child will turn out the right way? Well, it's pretty obvious that that's not what it means. So let's make some observations about it. I always love the expression of this guy. Proverbs 22:6 is not a promise. It is a warning. That's so key. It's a warning for parents to be actively involved in their child's rearing. Actually, taking Proverbs 22:6 as an ironclad promise violates the very nature in the Old Testament of a proverb. A proverb was never intended to be an absolute promise for everything for all time. It was never intended to be that. Proverbs were meant to be generalizations. That generally this is true, but there are exceptions to this. Right? For example, in the book of Proverbs, it talks about, if you obey my commands, then you will live a long life. All right? That is not an ironclad promise that's true in every situation, because in the very next book of the Bible, in the book of Ecclesiastes, also written by Solomon. Solomon says, I have seen a righteous man die young. Now, wait a minute. That's not supposed to be right. A righteous man is a person who obeys God. Proverbs says that that's not supposed to happen. Well, those are where in a sense, Proverbs gives us all the general rules of life. Ecclesiastes gives us all the exceptions to those rules. You know, that's what used to drive me crazy when I was in high school studying English. The English teacher would stand there and say, here's the rule, but here's all the exceptions. I hate it when they do that. Here's the rule, but here's all the exceptions. Well, God does the same thing. The rules are the book of Proverbs. The exceptions to the rules are the book of Ecclesiastes. All right? So the very nature of a proverb is a generalization. That is, generally this is true, but there are exceptions where there are This is not true. That's the nature of a proverb. So, that's the first thing. And the fact that this particular proverb is a general statement. In other words, these proverbs are not absolute guarantees, for they express truths that are necessarily conditioned by prevailing circumstances. So, if you take this as an absolute guarantee, then you place upon yourself expectations that even the perfect parent would not. Now, that's important. And the question then comes, has anybody ever been perfect? I don't know of any perfect parent except one. And the Bible gives us one example of a perfect parent. Take your Bible. Let's go over to Isaiah. Put a little marker here. So I'm going to mark this Proverbs 22:6 because we're going to come back here. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 1. And here is the perfect parent speaking. Verse 2. Isaiah 1:2. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. Children I have reared and brought up, but they have rebelled against me. Now, wait a minute. If Proverbs 22:6 is a promise, if it's a guarantee, then it didn't work for God. Here's the perfect parent speaking. He always did perfectly. Everything that his children needed, he provided. Everything, there was nothing that he did that was ever wrong, and yet his children still rebelled. Wow. You could find that to be true in your own life, even as an imperfect parent. To the best of your ability, you can do everything you can do that's right in your child's life, and that child, guess what? The Bible teaches this. Has a will of its own. Maybe you've seen that will. That child has a will of his own, her own, and they will express that will. What they want to do, you can see it. Our kids used to have a little phrase when they were little. They used to say, I'll do it my only way. That meant, I'm going to do it my way. I'll do it my only way. I'm going to do it my way. Well, that's them expressing their will. Even though mom and dad had a different will for them. So here is God speaking. He's the perfect parent. He always did the right thing for his children. He never did anything that was wrong. If you will, he always handled his children perfectly, and yet they still rebelled. That's potential. That's why we say in Christian parenting, there are no guarantees. You can influence your children, but you cannot determine your children. You can influence them, no doubt. Mom and dad have a huge influence in their life. Your home has a huge influence on their life, but you still can't determine them. This is really critical to understand. This is a promise. Let's go back to Proverbs 20. Or this is not a promise, I should say. It is a warning. Let's go back to Proverbs 22:6. Let's look at that carefully. Train or dedicate a child in the way he should go, upon the mouth of his way. When he is old, he will not depart from it. What is that really saying? It means implement your child rearing in their life. And let that child do his or her own thing. And when they grow up, they'll not depart from doing their own thing. That's why we say it is a warning. Dedicate your child over to letting them do their own thing upon the mouth of their way. And when they're old, they'll not depart from doing their own thing. It is really a call for parents to jump in the middle of that child's life and redirect that child's life in a different direction, even though ultimately you can't make the final decision for that child in their heart. That's between them and God. But you can point them in the right direction. You can influence them in the right direction. But you can't determine their right direction. That's really critical. A parallel verse to this is Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 16. I want to take a look at that. Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 16. It says, the rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself. That's a synonymous phrase to upon the mouth of his way. A child left to himself brings shame to his mother. So, again, this is a verse that implies that parents influence a child, and if you let a child do their own thing, if you take the laissez-faire approach to parenting and you let the child do his own thing, then eventually that child's going to bring disgrace or shame to his mother. That's really key. By the way, before he talks about the rod, I just want to make a sideline observation. Earlier in verse 11, he has talked about the fact that a fool gives full vent to his spirit, but a wise man quickly holds it back. That's where parents become abusive in child rearing. They discipline a child in anger, uncontrolled anger. That's giving full vent to your spirit, pouring out harshness. But a wise man holds it back. A wise man is self-controlled, is the idea. So he teaches that first. Then he teaches about the rod in verse 15. Then later he talks about the rod and reproof give understanding. But that assumes that the person who has the rod is actually using the rod according to the lines of wisdom and is self-controlled, not angry. One very prominent Christian psychologist used to teach, you should never discipline your child in anger. Well, if that was true, then I would never ever discipline my child. I was always angry when they did something wrong. The Bible doesn't teach that. You can discipline your child when you're angry, but you should never discipline your child when you are out of control with your anger. Never. There's a difference. So, the rod and reproof gives understanding, but a child left to himself, that little phrase, but left to himself, is the synonymous phrase to upon the mouth of his way, back in 22:6. Same thing, you let a child do his own thing, and when he is old, he'll not stop doing his own thing. Okay? You've got to interrupt them, redirect them, give them consequences. Children do not raise themselves. That's a disaster waiting to happen. So, the idea here is that children have sinful hearts. The Bible always assumes that. Let's go back to Proverbs 22:6. Later on, it says in verse 15, folly is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline drives it far from him. Folly is the same thing as natural sinfulness. Foolishness. It's that which is an ungodly set of decisions that ends up to reaping ungodly actions and ungodly thoughts and ungodly attitudes. All of that is encompassed in that word folly. That is bound up in the heart of a child. Isn't it amazing that you never have to teach your child to do wrong? You never have to do that. You're constantly trying to teach your child how to do right. Why is that? Because folly is bound up in every child's heart. I know some of you mothers think that your husband teaches your child to do wrong. But he doesn't have to help them very much. They're just going to do it naturally because of that folly. It's there. So challenging the sinful heart of your child is hard work. And it leaves no absolute guarantees. No absolute guarantees. Now, I'm going to wear your Bible out a little bit this weekend. So let's go back to Proverbs 29 and verse 16 again. Let's go back there. And I want you to notice a couple of things that are really key here. Second observation we want to make is that biblical child rearing must include a wise, progressive balance between structural and verbal discipline. Both of those are vitally important. Look very closely at verse 16 where it says, the rod, that's the structural. And reproof, that's the verbal. Give wisdom. There's a balance between those two things. It's vitally important that you understand the balance. The rod is the physical punishment. The reproof is the verbal correction. Or sometimes that includes instruction. Or sometimes that includes rebuke, verbal rebuke. Those have to be used in balance. And it takes a wise parent to know how to balance that out in your children. So a wise parenting requires a wise administration of both types of discipline during the growth of a child. And failure, then, to establish and maintain this balance will result in an unruly or frustrated child. You can see that when it says, there but a child left to himself brings shame, or the idea is disgrace, to his mother. The child becomes disgraceful. So a child who is not disciplined and left to himself is allowed to do as he pleases and have whatever he wants. There in verse 15. That's what he does. And he will become an unruly person. He will disgrace or bring shame upon his parents when that happens. Now, there is a parallel verse to this in the New Testament. Let's go over to the New Testament and put a little marker here in 29 and verse 15. And let's go over to the New Testament, Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. Paul picks up on this, even as New Testament believers, when he talks about the fact fathers, here the Greek term that's used for fathers, patera, is where we get our word parent from. It's talking to fathers most directly because as heads of the home, they're primarily responsible. But a mother is also included in this admonition. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Now look at that carefully, because the discipline is the word here, paideia. It is the word that means structural discipline. It is the word that means physical punishment. And that word is balanced with the next word, which talks about instruction. It's the word nuthesia, which means to admonish, to warn, or counsel. It has to do with the verbal. Again, this parallels exactly what Solomon has said in Proverbs 29:15, when it talks about the rod and reproof. And here it talks about the structural discipline or the physical punishment. Sometimes that includes corporal punishment of the child, balanced with the verbal or instruction that's given a child, nuthesia, instruction of a child. So the implication here is that God now has created every child with a conscience that can be responsive to both the corrective training, in this sense physical, as well as the instruction or teaching that needs to be there. And there is this biblical balance between the two. It's a critical one, and I want you to see this. And I think there in your notes is a good example of this. It looks something like this, where Proverbs 29:15, Ephesians 6:4 now are a balanced picture of what really Christian parenting should look like. From the time that a child is born to the time that they're 20 years of age is approximate time that we have the greatest influence in their life. What should that look like in terms of balance? Well, it should look something like this. In giving them wisdom. In other words, when a child is much younger, there is going to be much more of an emphasis upon the rod, that is training, nurturing, structural parameters, physical correction. When that child is young, you know this, you can tell a one-year-old kid, you can lecture that kid until you're blue in the face about all the wrongs that they've done, and they'll sit there and just kind of back at you, all right? They're not open to it. But when you smack their hands or paddle their little bottom, then you've got their attention. When a child is much younger, that's when the physical punishment and consequences have to be there. The setting of the parameters, if you will, where a child is corrected. But as that child grows up, that becomes less and less effective, and then there becomes a greater and greater need for instruction, admonition, rebuke, verbal correction. You know, some kids grow and they get 11, 12, 13 years of age, and you can try to paddle that kid and they'll say, "What hit me?" You know, they're your physical equal. They're pretty tough. It makes little impact on them. But you take away their internet privileges and you think the whole world's come to an end. All right? You take away something that's meaningful to them, now that speaks to them. So parents have to learn these kind of things. As that child grows older and older, there's less physical parameters in that child's life and much more verbal input and direction for that child to understand. And by the way, that child through those years are growing in terms of their mental maturity and their ability to understand language and the subtle inferences and shades of meaning that are important in their own maturity. And you're able to spend more time talking with them, instructing them along the lines of righteousness. So as the child grows, there's less and less physical discipline, much more and more moral or verbal discipline. And as the child grows and learns his or her environment, The child must grow in their understanding of their own sinful heart and the difference that the grace of God can make in their heart. And this is where the verbal input and instruction becomes so vital. It's so critical. It starts with instruction in terms of salvation, but it continues as that child grows in grace. It's critical for the Christian parents to learn how to gradually let up on making all the decisions for a child and instructing that child on how they need to make the decisions that are going to be godly decisions. Sometimes we talk about this with parents in counseling. We say to them, every discipline event becomes an opportunity for the gospel. Say, how is that possible? Every discipline event becomes an opportunity for the gospel. Once that child grows up and understands language better. Because every time you discipline your child, you should be saying to your child, what is it that God expects of you? And you understand that the answer to that question it's easy to say, but it's complex in its understanding. Most children say, God expects me to obey. Oh, no, that's not what God expects. God expects you to be 100% perfect. That's what God expects of you. And most children, the younger they are, will think, well, you know what? I can do that. They will. I can do that. And so they'll go about trying to be 100% perfect. I know that's what pleases God. And they'll fail. And they get punished for it. And then you say to them, what does God expect of you? God expects me to be perfect. Or try again. So I'm going to go back in there. Try it again. And they fail again. And they get punished for it. And say, what does God expect of you? God expects me to be perfect. That's right. And they try really hard the next time. And they fail again. And they get the consequences. What does God expects me to be perfect. But I can't. I can't do it. And that's when the door swings wide open for the gospel. Do you understand? That's why you need Christ. That's why you need Christ. Most kids grow up, don't think they need Christ. Because they've never been taught that they really need Christ. They've never been taught that. You have to teach them that. What does God expect you? God expects you to be 100% perfect. And a kid will think that they can do that until they repeatedly are reminded of it. Repeatedly reminded of it. Every discipline event becomes an opportunity for the gospel. Everything. And then the door swings wide open for those kids. I can't do it. You're right. You're right. You're right. That's why you need Christ. Now you talk to him about why Christ came. Why he died. You know, most kids that make a profession of faith, they actually believe in the foolishness of their own heart. Well, certainly Jesus died for me. I'm worth dying for. Absolutely. There's no realization of the fact that there's nothing in them that was worth dying for. Nothing. Nothing. Which just magnifies the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ, doesn't it? It just magnifies it. 100-fold. 1,000-fold. Christ did not die for us because we were worth dying for. Mm-mm. In spite of the fact that we weren't worth dying for, he died for us. So, every discipline event becomes an opportunity for the gospel. There has to be this biblical balance. It is a balance between structural parameters, physical correction on the one hand, and then verbal instruction and input on the other hand. And it takes a wise parent as that child grows and matures on how to let up on the structural discipline, how to give more informed biblical instruction to that child as time goes on. That's really critical. Now, we all realize that what we've got here on the chart is the ideal Christian home. From a biblical perspective, this is exactly what happened. But you and I don't have ideal homes. So what do we do? How do we handle this? This is what should be happening. How do we handle this? That's a great question. And I'm going to answer that after we take our break.